Welcome again to Cottage Talk. I'm Russ Goldman, co-hosting with me today is David Hulley and Mike Gregg. In this episode, we will be previewing the upcoming match for Fulham at home against Brentford at Craven Cottage. We also have many topics to get through, as much has happened to Fulham since their last victory against Huddersfield Town. Before we get going, I have to welcome my Cottage Talk co-host back to the show first. David, how are you doing? It's been a long time since we talked.
Yeah, it seems to be ages, doesn't it, when we haven't got a show for a couple of weeks. But, you know, the time soon flies by. There's always something to talk about, and lots of things have been happening since we've been on. And it's been a lovely day here in the UK. We've had a nice, warm, sunny day for a change, which is nice. I've been busy stock checking, unfortunately. End of my financial year on the 31st of March, so I've been counting boxes on a lovely, fine, sunny day. What a shame. Anyway, let's get going and talk about all the exciting stuff, eh?
Absolutely. And listen, it's a nice sunny day here as well. It's probably in the mid-50s Fahrenheit here. It's really nice. But I'm looking forward to talking Fulham with you, David. But it looks like we also have Mike on the line with us. Mike, how you doing, my friend?
Yeah, I'm good, Russ. It's good to speak to you and get this international break out of the way. And I think it was a break we all needed, really, and there's a lot happened, and we can gear up for the last 7 games.
Absolutely. Listen, there's so much to get through. It's funny. I've opened it up for 2 hours. We'll see how things go. You know, we might be able to get everything in within 90 minutes. I also have Kit's interview with Sarah that I definitely want to play. That's about 8 minutes long, so we have a ton to get through. But Mike, one thing that I do want to mention, because we are going to do one segment about two posts that actually you have on Viva El Fulham. I look forward to talking to you about the survey. You actually just posted the results, and also a very nice article that you wrote, a very in-depth article, Mike. I want to applaud you for both posts, my friend.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed doing both of them. I've been in my day job, I've been really busy for the last month, so it was nice to sort of get my head down and write something about Fulham.
No, listen, you did an excellent job. I look forward to really getting into it with you in a little bit and get David's thoughts on your article and also your survey, which again, the results were interesting as well. We'll definitely get to that. But let's start here, guys. And, Mike, I will start with you in Cottage Talk Quick Shots. And last Thursday, Fulham announced the loan signings of midfielder Danny Guthrie from Reading and goalkeeper Richard Lee from Brentford until the end of the season. What are your thoughts about both of these signings, Mike?
Well, it was a typical Fulham last day, you know, rumours in the morning and then, you know, two signings before the end of the window. The Richard Lee one, the goalkeeper one's a very odd loan signing. He's going to retire. He's going to become a writer or something. And I don't really, he's been injured. So that's a really odd one. But I think some of us have been saying we wanted another goalkeeper. Otherwise, you know, could have Corrali in for a few games. So he's just there as backup, isn't he? And hopefully nothing's going to happen and Betts is going to play every game. The Guthrie one is probably the kind of player we should be looking at. I know he's had a bad time at Reading and, you know, some of the press he gets isn't very good. But when he first came on the scene, you know, he did score a cracking goal against us. He was getting good press and you know, a couple of decent moves, but like a lot of players, they go somewhere and it doesn't quite work out. So he's out of contract, I believe, in the summer.
We've got a couple of months
to look at him and see whether, you know, he's worth taking on for next year. I don't see a downside to this particular one because he is, like I say, mid-20s, 27, I think he is, and you know, for next year's championship, he has the skill. There's no doubt about that. Whether he has the application, that's something else. But I'm happy with Guthrie signing.
So am I, Mike. I see this as a win-win. You know, it's a prove-it situation for him, you know, because he's playing for his next contract. Like you mentioned, he's going to be out of contract. And we have a couple months to take a look at him. And if we like him, maybe we will sign him after his contract ends with Reading. I see no downside here. I think it's actually a good sign to bring in a player like this. They've got nothing to lose and everything to gain. You know, if he plays well, maybe he'll get a contract with Fulham. And it really is a good situation because he's going to be geared to wanting to play well because he's looking to get paid. So I think it's a win-win situation. David, over to you. What are your thoughts about these two signings?
Well, the goalie is a strange one, isn't it? I mean, you know, a, a goalkeeper that's just coming here. I mean, it's, you know, we do have other goalkeepers, of course. You know, we have Joranen hopefully coming back soon. So perhaps it's just to bridge the gap. It's strange that we've got probably two goalkeepers at the end of their career now as to choose from as a reserve, as opposed to obviously one at the moment. But I guess anything that stops Pyjamas getting in the team has got to be a good thing in the main, even though, you know, as I said to you the other day, shockingly, he kept his clean sheet again for his country, I believe. So
he did?
He can't be all bad. Danny Guthrie, all I can say on this is that he's a player I don't really like. And
okay.
In the same way, I didn't like Scott Parker when he played for other teams. So if you turn that round, perhaps it could be a great signing because, you know, I just never liked Scott Parker. I thought he had a bit of a nasty side to him. But when you see him, what he does for you, I think is excellent. And I think Danny Guthrie is a bit the same, you know. I've seen a few naughty challenges from him in the past, but he does have some ability as well. Perhaps he's a bit of a kind of a Joey Barton type player in another way, without quite the bad temperament. Someone who does have, you know, some talent and skill and ability to play in that midfield role, but he has to just make sure he doesn't get himself in trouble. So it is a win-win situation in a way that we get him for a few months and he's going to be out of contract, so therefore I don't know if there's any overriding deals, but you would have thought that if we like what we see, then we have the chance to make it permanent in the summer.
Right, and that's why I think it's a good situation for Fulham and for him, and we'll see how it goes. It's funny, you brought up some really good analogies. You mentioned Joey Barton. I was thinking about that as well. Like you said, maybe not the same temperament, hopefully, you know, but you're talking skill level. And, you know, the Scotty Parker one is an interesting one, David, because, again, I'm thinking about players that in other sports that I haven't liked when they played for other teams, but when they come to play for your team, you know, you want players like that because, again, you know, they give you something that maybe you didn't have. And I do like that Scotty Parker analogy because, you know, you don't like him when he plays against you, but you might like him when he plays for you. So again, I think this is a good situation. Bring in a player, just 7 matches, and we'll see what happens. So I do like the move. The Lee one is puzzling, but again, you know, David, you know, we've talked about Pyjamas, so I guess it's good to have backup, you know, have another backup goalkeeper. So, you know, like you mentioned, he's near the end of his career, and as Mike mentioned, he's retiring. So it's a strange one, but, you know, again, it's just another player for backup. I don't see a big deal with Richard Lee. I think it's more the bigger situation is bringing in Danny Guthrie for me. All right, David, right back to you. The club also confirmed last Wednesday the loan swap until the end of the season for Fulham defender Fernando Amorebieta going to Middlesbrough and left-back James Husband coming back to Fulham. What are your thoughts on this loan swap?
Well, it smacked almost of a Felix Magath-type move that two players who have maybe fallen out of favour with Kit for getting themselves sent off, I don't know, could be out in one fell swoop here because Amorebieta going, obviously, that is a strange one. You don't see Middlesbrough as being kind of the place to send someone, you know, like this normally and what his role would be there. But also Husband coming to Fulham and he plays as an attacking left back normally. So does that mean that Stafleidis is out on his ear as well? Or is he planning to play him in front of Stafleidis? But, you know, it's funny because, as I say, Amorebieta, you know, he's got himself sent off and he's out. Stafleidis got himself sent off. Could he be out as well? Obviously, you know, from what I've seen, I would tend to think that Husband is going to play tomorrow. This could be, you know, fraught with dangers having a whole new back four again like after we changed it recently for, I think it was for the Bournemouth game, wasn't it, or something? Or was it the Leeds game? It's been so long, I can't remember now. But, yeah, I mean, it's dangerous, you know, to keep changing, you know, teams around, but I have a feeling he will be playing for some reason. And so what is the point of bringing him here if he's not going to play, I suppose? That's
exactly
the other thing, isn't it? And again, he's someone who's down the pecking order a bit at Middlesbrough, so I'm not sure if there's some thought about getting him in longer term. But say his official position is wing-back, so he's the sort of person who could fit with that 3-5-2 type scenario. But I don't see Kit making a change at this stage of the season, really. So I think he'd be more used as a left-back who perhaps is better going forward than we've had.
It's interesting, David, because, again, you bring up a very good point. Why is he coming here? You know, he's coming here because he's probably going to play. And you bring up a very interesting analogy. And, Mike, I want to ask you about David's theory about Felix McGath, you know, a little bit like McGath with the situation with Fernando Morbieta and possibly Kostas Stafoulidis being a factor in this loan swap there. What are your thoughts about the loan swap and what David brought up?
Well, I mean, as you know, I've never been a big fan of Amberetta, and I think David's probably right that the sending off had something to do with it. I'm also led to believe that his fitness had something to do with it as well, and a disciplinary issue. So that's why he's been shipped out. We're bringing someone in. It's a bit of an odd one, but it does look as if Stafoulidis is just going to twiddle his thumbs for the rest of the season, because you have Kavanagh as well.
Right.
And I would have liked to have seen Kavanagh get a run. I know David thinks he's a bit lightweight, but there's seven games left. We're going to dig out a couple of wins from somewhere. We're going to be fine, but give him those six or seven games in his natural position and see how he does. But I agree with what Dave says. It looks like he's going to go straight in, so we're going to have another different back four. Just like the Bournemouth game, it's moving deck chairs around at the back all the time, and nothing's settled at all. I mean, we don't know who's going to play Bodroff, or will it be Bodroff? That'd be a brand new back four again. But Ambrett going, he's going to go in the summer, no doubt. Chance to look at this guy and see whether he's someone to bring in next year. But really, when you look at what the squad we have. Do we want another 21-year-old coming into the squad in the summer at left back? If anything, you could argue we need a bit more experience than that. He's going to play. We'll see how he does. But I'm disappointed because I wanted Kavanagh to get a run.
I hear you on that. And listen, David has mentioned about the fact that Kavanagh does look a little bit lightweight. I kind of see where David's going on that, because I've thought about that as well. But Kavanagh actually has impressed me, Mike, in midfield, but would you be more apt? You'd be more apt to play him at left back than put him in the midfield. Then we're talking about Kavanagh.
Yeah, because I think Kavanagh going forward doesn't offer as much in midfield. So Fofana's had a couple of decent performances in midfield as well, and we've got another option with Guthrie. So it would have made sense to, just drop Kavanagh back and let him have that run if Stafoulidis is going to be out of the picture completely. But it obviously doesn't look like it. I know Kit obviously sees Kavanagh as a nice defensive, solid option there, and it's good that he's in the squad. I just feel his natural position is left back. And
right.
What are we going to do now? Are we going to wait until next season to see whether he can do the job?
Oh, it's actually a very interesting point that you make there, Mike, because, again, we have seven matches. And this might be a good opportunity, like you're talking about, to possibly see what Kavanagh can do at left back. But you are bringing in a left back who's probably possibly auditioning for the position. Moving forward, what happens if they like Husband? Who knows? They might want to try to purchase him after the loan is over. So it's an interesting one, because again, you only bring in a player if you're going to play him. So I have a feeling, like David had said, that James Husband could feature as quickly as tomorrow. Very interesting situation that we're going to have to look at with many different players. But Mike, getting back to you, the back four is really just unsettled, and the fact that Hutchinson's going to be out, does that concern you in this match? I know we're going to be talking about that a little bit later, but the fact that Hutchinson isn't going to be involved. Do you think that possibly we could see Dan Byrne instead of Nikolai Bodaroff?
No.
It would be Bodaroff. Because came on as sub last week, and, Simons doesn't rate Byrne. We've already spoken about that in the past, and that's been made quite clear.
I'm just saying, because you happen to mention it.
I think Bodaroff, you could spin a coin between Bodaroff and Hutchinson, and either one of them can go in next to Turner, really. So it'd be a good chance for Bodaroff. I think he was a little bit unlucky to be dropped. He's been
okay.
In, you know, he's been a good, solid player for us. He's made a few mistakes, but it'll be good to see him playing tomorrow.
Okay, very, very good. And David, I know how you feel about Dan Byrne, so I don't even have to ask you your thoughts on that. But let's move on. And Mike, I'm going to go right back to you. The Daily Mail reported earlier this week that Southampton could make a move this summer for Fulham goalkeeper Martin Stekelenburg, currently out on loan with Monaco. What are your thoughts on this speculation?
Well, he's going to be linked with a number of clubs, but I mean, he's gone to Monaco and he's getting a nice suntan, obviously, because he's only played a couple of games, I think, and he's got a glass shoulder, hasn't he? What a mistake that was, buying him a couple of years ago for a lot of money as well, and I bet he's on a fair whack as well, and hopefully Monaco are paying all of it. So yeah, he's going to be one to be offloaded if he goes to Southampton. Good luck to him. I'd be surprised, though, to be honest. I think he'll find another club in Europe if we can offload him. I wouldn't even be surprised to see us come to a deal and just let him go for nothing if he's willing to, accept not taking his wages for his last year or two for contract. But, the sooner Stekelenburg goes, it's another one off the wage bill.
I totally agree with you on that, and that'll go back to what we're going to be talking about a little bit later about the financial situation. I think that would be an important move to at least get his wages off the books. David, what are your thoughts about this speculation?
Yeah, it's. I don't see any way back for him at Fulham really now, because the way Bettinelli's come through and the promise that Joran's shown, and I think they'll be looking to get rid of him, get rid of his wages. Yeah, I agree. It was a move we should have never made in the first place. It just really hasn't worked out for us. And you talk about players that we don't like at other clubs and that we like at Fulham. Well, it's probably the other way around, isn't it? We could say the same for him, maybe Brian Ruse and a few others. We don't like them much at Fulham. We'd like to see them at other clubs. So I think, yeah, the sooner that he's on his way, probably the better for everyone else. So, yeah, I agree totally.
Okay, fantastic. I think it's best that they part ways with him somehow this summer. And I agree with Mike. You know, if you can't recoup the transfer fee, I think that you would have to consider just trying to settle with him and getting his wages off the books. I think that would be very important as we look towards the summer. You know, we're talking about summer, but David, I want to go right back to you because there's also speculation last week from the Express that Olympiacos are looking for a bargain fee for Kostas Mitroglou, who's currently with the Greek side on loan from Fulham. He was with them prior, but he is now on loan back with the team that he played with prior. What are your thoughts on this speculation? And if you're Fulham, wouldn't you try to get as much as you could for Kostas Mitroglou if you are going to sell this player?
Well, here again, we have kind of a mirror of the Brian Ruiz situation. We had this massive long debate and, you know, who wants him? We've been touting him around everywhere, around the whole of Europe to see, you know, what we're going to get. And, of course, we've ended up with four-fifths of you-know-what. And this is
right.
The same situation with Mitroglou, isn't it, I guess? That, you know, we have to find that balance between whether we can recoup the money for him or whether we have to let him go to get him off the books. I mean, either way, I don't think we're going to do very well out of it, really. We either keep hold of him and his value goes down and we pay him wages, or we let him go for cheap to get the wages off, but then we don't recoup the transfer fee. So I just can't see any way where we would recoup our money, because he hasn't done anything particularly to demonstrate to the world that he is worth that fee. In his time at Fulham, I know he's rated in Greece by Olympiacos, obviously, but who else actually rates him? What else has he done? What is the standard of that league compared to other leagues? So
that's a good
I fear
point.
That we'll be stuck with, you know, the Brian Ruiz kind of situation where he'll just stay with us and see his contract out if we're going to hold out for a high fee, and you know, there's going to be no winners.
Very interesting take there, David. And, Mike, I'm going to go to you because, you know, again, I'm trying to think of the summer, and I think the summer is so key for Fulham, and I think part of that is going to be offloading players. We already talked about Stekelenburg. I think Mitroglou is going to be another player that they should try to offload. The question is, how aggressive are they trying to get the price? You know, again, you know, do you let them go you know, do you let him go for a discounted rate, or do you try to get as much as you can for this player? I'm curious your thoughts about the speculation and also what you would do in this situation if you were in charge of Fulham.
Well, he's on a decent length contract, so you know, if anyone wants him, they, especially if they, you know, they've had him on loan, and the Greeks, they're going to look for some kind of bargain, aren't they? They've got a strong hand. They can say to us, you know, we'll give you $1 million, $2 million, we'll take him off your hands. And it might even get that silly after all the money we spent on him just to get him off the books. He's not going to be happy staying. I mean, what was the headline? End his nightmare at Fulham. He's hardly spent a week here, so he hasn't had any time to have any nightmares. I mean, you know, he's been injured, gone back home, and, he scored some goals out there, so, you know, maybe that is his standard. Might depend a lot on who becomes manager, you know. I mean, in the end, he's still going to be getting paid by us, and he's got to be at least championship standard, hasn't he? Because we've seen him score goals in the Champions League. So it's either get rid of him for a few million, or you say you're under contract, we need a striker for next season, we're not going to spend money on it, on buying another one. You do your job and you stay here. But I think in the end, we'll let him go for a couple of million. We'll sort some kind of deal out with the Greeks, and we can say goodbye to another £10 million flop. So my only hope is that, I know we never paid £10 million for McCormick, but, you know, that's the listed price. But if he ends up leaving us in 2 years for nothing, then, you know, you can just go through him. Marley, you know, Ruiz, Andy Johnson, we just split these players, just spend loads on them and just let them go for nothing almost. And, it's just been a disaster. No one knows who bought him. We'd all like to just move on. And you're telling summer is massive.
It is, Mike, and that's why, you know, again, that's why I wanted to talk about this, because, again, when I was reading your article, I was just thinking about this summer and thinking about the moves Fulham have to make, and part of that is offloading some of the baggage. And I'm going to put Mitroglou and Stekelenburg in the baggage category, and I personally think that they need to try as best as they can to get as much as they can for these guys. And I know about getting them off the books, that's very important as well. But I think that it's also important with financial fair play as well that they try to get as much as they can for these guys, you know, because, again, financial fair play, you're going to hear a lot more about it as the years go on, and we're going to need to get as much money as we can for these guys. You know, yes, we're going to be taking losses, but we need to maximize as much as we can for them. But we'll see. You know, we'll see what Fulham do this summer. But again, these are the two players that I'm going to be looking at, along with, you know, again, David, the situation with Brian Ruiz. We're going to be looking at that as well. So the Fulham need to, in my opinion, they need to clear out the baggage, but they need to get some money for the baggage. All right, let's move on. And David, I'm going to go to you. Marcus Bettinelli made his debut for the England Under-21s last Friday, kept a clean sheet in their victory against the Czech Republic. Colin Woodrow also started this match and played in the second half until he was subbed off. What are your thoughts about these appearances for both of these players playing for England?
Well, I think it's fantastic that that although we are in the Championship and we're a long way down the Championship, that at least someone is looking at us and guys are getting recognition. And I think Marcus especially has done a good job in the main in a difficult situation in a team that have been playing badly or performing badly, letting goals in. And I think he saved a lot more than he's let in. I mean, you look at back even to, you know, the match at Huddersfield, and that penalty save probably changed the whole match. So it's great for him and Corley as well. I mean, he hasn't had a massive look in. You know, he's unfortunately been behind Hugo most of the time, and then he's been, you know, he's behind Matt Smith as well probably now. But he's always given a good effort, and he definitely does bring something to the team. He has, you know, he needs to probably work on his finishing a bit more. But his hold-up play and his energy is pretty good. But I think that's fantastic. I was disappointed, obviously, they didn't get to start in the other game, although that was only a friendly, of course, wasn't it, I think. And this was an away game in the Czech Republic in Prague. So I'd say this was, for me, was I know it was against Germany the other one, but this for me was the harder game. So they came through. They came through the harder test, in my opinion, and did well. And the only reason I think they were left out was purely rotation, so that obviously they could have a look at as many people as possible in the friendly. But I think it's really good, and it's a shame, obviously, that Betts is, I think, 22, nearly 23. So his chances for the under 21s are almost up, because, as you probably know, they have a strange way of doing it. I think it's they have a cycle, and anyone who's at 21 or less at the start of the cycle, like the qualifying period, can then play in that team, so they don't have chopping and changing around. I.e., so the group, the same group of players can play together throughout. So I think at the end of this cycle, which is, I guess, in the summer, he won't be eligible to play for the under-21s anymore. So he will be reliant on, you know, any snippets of a chance for the senior squad. But nevertheless, it's a good stepping stone for him and for Corley as well, who's obviously a bit younger, and he may have another chance. Michael probably know better than me the exact rules, but I think you have to be under 21 at the start, and it's like a two-year period, I think, a two-year qualifying period, so that each qualifying section for the Euro under-21s or something, they have a two-year run, if you know what I mean. So, as I say,
right,
that they don't have to keep chopping and changing the squad because one of them turns more than 21. So as long as they're 21 at the start or less, they then can play for 2 years.
Oh, good stuff there, David. And, you know, it's funny because I was disappointed, like you, that they didn't play against Germany, but like you said, they did play against the Czech Republic, and I got a chance to watch some of it. It was just great to see both of these foam players playing for England. England under 21s. I think it's great. I really do, and I'm glad that both of them got that opportunity. Mike, I want to go to you. Maybe you can clear up the rules for us, and I also want to get your thoughts about both these players playing for the England under 21s against the Czech Republic.
The rules are as clear as mud, like any FA or UEFA rules. But basically, if the tournament is, let's say the tournament is in July 2016, you have to be 20 or under in the year the qualifying starts. So if the qualifying starts in 2014, if you are 20 on the 1st of January, then you can play two and a half years later in the competition. So, yeah, it's a little bit complicated, but it's similar to what David said. It's a two-year cycle, so you can be in the finals at 23 as long as you were 20 the year that the qualifying started, if that makes sense. But you have to read it to understand it. But it's good recognition for the club and for the players, and it wasn't only that age group. You know, Pat Roberts played a couple of games and scored. Under-17s as well. So, it just proves that, the youth policy which was put in place and the academy which was, partly what McIntosh's job was when he was when he became the CEO, was to build up the academy, is showing, results now. The problem is it's probably a couple of years too late. It was 2 years too late to save us in a way for the Premier League. But, it's really good. And Bettinelli, I agree with David, he's saved us a lot this year, and he deserves that recognition. And Woodrow's obviously someone who Southgate now trusts. He's seen him for over a year in the squad, and although he hasn't scored much for him, he obviously sees him as a good squad player. So I'm hopeful that he's going to get more games going forward with the under-21s as well.
Oh, that's great, and I'm glad that you mentioned that about Southgate trusting Woodrow, and hopefully, like I said, this will continue for him, and it's just nice to see both of these players come through, and I'm glad that you mentioned Mike. Pat Roberts as well, and the recognition that the academy is getting. And very good point. Unfortunately, it's probably a couple of years too late. But again, this is a new cycle for Fulham. It's going to take time to regenerate and get us back where we want to be. But the academy is going to be a major part of it. And it's just good to see it getting recognized with these players. All right, Mike, I'm going to come right back to you. Finally, Fulham have been fined £20,000 for the incident that happened in the Leeds match, which – results Fulham being charged with failing to ensure its players conducted themselves in an orderly fashion. Mike, what are your thoughts about the charge?
Well, I mean, they did confront the ref, and they did complain. I mean, there were lots of people moaning, you know, Chelsea get away with it, Villa get away with it, or, you know, but I think they all get little fines. Yeah, I know. And but we broke the rules, so I'm quite happy with it. You know, you shouldn't go and confront the ref, so you get fined. But the fines, let's be honest, are petty. And the only way you're going to stop clubs and players from doing this is player bans and points reductions.
Right.
These little fines for racial abuse, for confronting refs, you know, any of this kind of stuff. You've got to hit clubs where it hurts now, and that's not £20,000 fines. Points and suspensions is the only way to go for me. So, yes, we deserved it. We got fined. We move on.
Okay. Fair enough there, Mike, and very good analysis of the situation with fines and the situation with the referees and your thoughts on what you think should be done in the future. David, what are your thoughts about the fine?
Well, I'm much the same, except I wasn't going to mention the other club in Fulham, obviously. But
right.
We've broke the rules. The annoying thing is, though, it's right that, you know, how comes we've been made an example of? What about all the other clubs? You see a lot worse. You know, I can remember Man United once around Andy Durso at Old Trafford, about nine of them all pushing and jostling him. I mean, the only way to deal with it, I mean, it's dissent to start off with. A dissent is a yellow card. So much as it looks officious and petty, start getting the yellow card out. And everyone who comes around and argues with you and jostles with you, get the yellow card out.
Right.
If anyone uses foul or abusive language, it's a red card offence with a 2-game ban. Get the red. If someone swears at the ref and says you effing cheat or something like that, get the red card out then. I mean, it's very rare you see it. It's very rare you see it. I think the last I remember seeing it was Patrick Berger against Fulham, I think at Loftus Road. I think it was Alan Wiley. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah, David, I actually just, believe it or not, I just saw it. Yesterday, I saw it with the U.S. men's national team. Jose Altidore got one.
Did it?
It looked like, again, you could read lips. If you could read lips, you know, he got a red card.
I mean, it was a shock. He was still on his feet then, wasn't it, with Altidore? Because he normally spends most of the match face down. But, I know it sounds officious, and like no one wants to see referees being officious, but just for start, just get the yellow card out. If anyone argues with you, get the yellow card out. And if anyone's abusive to you, get the red card out. And that would, at least in the short term, hopefully, you know, clubs would get fined and players would be suspended or whatever for too many yellow cards, and maybe the managers would then, like, do something about it. The trouble is, obviously, you know, some clubs seem to have much more leniency than others, it appears. And, you know, we've had lots of mind games in the past, you know, Man United and stuff, and Alex Ferguson, and he seems to be able to strike the refs out and other managers as well. And we have the same with Mourinho from the other club in Fulham, obviously.
Right.
But that would be the thing, that you know, there needs to be more respect, because there has to be respect at the top level of football before you get respect at the bottom level, unfortunately, I think, because everybody watches, you know, professional football, and if they see these things go on, they try it on the park on Sunday, and you know, that's the hardest thing. The refs on a Sunday don't get the protection. I mean, the refs in the Premier League get the protection, really. If something happens to them, you know, all hell breaks loose. But Sunday league football and stuff, as Mike will know, we've played this football, the refs have a really hard job. So you need it to come from the top down, I think, and start giving out yellow end cards, and everyone sees the refs mean business. And that would put a stop to all these things. And there should be, like in rugby, I don't know how it works exactly, but I think everything goes through the captain. The captain's allowed to approach the ref, and the captain's allowed almost maybe to argue with the ref or to put a point across. But it should come through him. But all this surrounding the refs, no, it's just petulant and stuff, and it's ridiculous. And so, yeah, it's right to be fined. It's just, it's not right that there doesn't seem to be any consistency in the game.
No, good stuff. Good stuff from both of you on this situation. Mike said, it's, you know,
back,
again, I just... I'm sorry, Mike,
Russ,
do you have something else you wanted to add?
Yeah, can I just come back? Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, we've mentioned it before that, you know, whenever there's an incident, it's probably difficult to see on a live feed or, you know, just on TV, but I'm sure Dave will back me up. When there is an incident, especially near our goal, Hutchinson and Bettinelli will race yards to get to the referee and have a go at him. I'm sure David's seen that. And it is a streak in our team, which you could argue is good. They're fighting and battling for each other. But you end up with silly fines and silly sendings off. And, you know, I put it down to a lack of discipline on the pitch. And, you know, it's something we need to improve on.
It's a good point, David. I'm sorry, Mike. Sorry about that. Nothing against either one of you. What was that, David?
Dan Byrne was very guilty of it when he played regularly as well.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm glad, Mike. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because the minute you mentioned those players, I was going back and thinking about situations that they would be running at the ref, but you guys would see it obviously much better being right at Craven Cottage. You could really see it. So very good by you to bring that up, because it is a little bit about discipline. It could also be about lack of experience, you know, but on the flip side, I'm glad that you mentioned this as well, Mike. It also shows that they care, but you need to harness that energy and not let it hurt you, and unfortunately sometimes it can hurt you, so you got to show a little bit of discipline. Hopefully they will learn from this. All right, let's move on, let's go to the section I'm calling the Mike Gregg section, because Mike has posted some very interesting articles, a survey on vivaelfulham.co.uk. I would recommend everyone going to this wonderful website. Mike, along with the other writers, do an excellent job. And Mike, I'm going to start with you. We're going to go through your survey and also your recent article. Let's start with a survey and just share with David and myself what you found out from your findings from your latest survey. I'm reading it here. 411 people took part in this survey. So just share with us what you found out from it.
Yeah, so people who know me, I do surveys occasionally. I haven't done one for quite a while. So I thought, well, let's see who people want to keep for next season. Who should we keep from the loans? Who should we sell? You know, let's see what kind of squad people want next year. So I sent it out on Twitter. It ran for under 24 hours, and to get 400 replies was well above average. You usually get about 200, so just shows, you know, people were missing Fulham maybe a little bit, you know, stuck in the middle of the international break. So it was something for them to do. But anyway, we started with what I called a simple question, which is, should Kit still be manager at the start of next season? And so I sort of threw it in there, didn't tell anyone about it. Everyone thought it was about players. And the interesting thing was, you know, 63% said no, he shouldn't. And that was a lot higher than I expected. I mean, I'm still, you know, I'm maybe 40-60 that he shouldn't be. But, you know, I thought it would be almost 55-45 for him not to be manager. I still thought there was a bit more support. So, you know, if you have two-thirds of the fans not wanting the current manager to be in charge next season, that's a complete reversal to when McGaff went, when it was two-thirds wanted Simons in charge initially. So he's sort of lost it, really. He's lost that support since Christmas with the run we've had and you know, some of the tactics and selections he's made.
No, good stuff, Mike. And, you know, and again, that was obviously the one thing that jumps off the page when you see that amount and see that it's basically two-thirds of the fans don't want him to be the manager at the start of the season. And, you know, again, that number kind of surprised me as well. You know, I thought there might be a majority, but I didn't think it would be that high. But it certainly was that high. And also, you go into details, you have everyone pick the players that they'd want to be part of the team next year. Did anything stand out to you in the results? Anything shock you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we start with the goalkeepers, Bettinelli and Johnman, people want to keep them and release Steckenberg and Corrales, so no real surprise there. Kavanagh won the most votes to stay as a defender, surprisingly. But it was mainly the starters. You know, Kavanagh, Grimmer, Hutchison, Byrne, Bodroff, they're all wanted for next year. The biggest shock for me was Ambrosetta only getting, you know, 12% of people wanting to keep him. I mean, leading up to the Bournemouth game, there were so many people who wanted him back. He's going to be strong, he's experienced and all this. And I think that one game seems to have turned everyone against him. And so that was a surprise for me. I definitely expected that to be a lot higher. Into midfield, I like the fact that Christensen, Roberts, George Williams and Heidman were the top four. And David pointed out on Twitter that three of those players played in the Rotherham game. And, you know, those four, that would be an interesting midfield to see next season. It's a very
right.
young midfield. But, you know, maybe look, I doubt it's going to happen, but maybe look 2 to 3 years ahead if they were still here. You know, that's a decent balanced midfield. Two midfielders, one who's attacking, one who holds and passes, and two wide men. So, and Kakanicic, he's got a good score as well, and, you know, I was glad for him there. And then really the rest, you know, Parker and Tuncliffe, they make the cut, and then it's 50-50 on David Eisfeld and everyone else, really. So, and strikers-wise, well, we're easy. We've got 30% of the vote. So, again, you know, 70% of the people just, you know, sell, let go. They don't want him here. And let's go with Woodrow, McCormick, Smith, Dembele and Taggart. And
yeah.
Choglu, you can go. Rodallega, let's not extend your contract. And so you end up with, if you look at just the players who have played this year, so not the youngsters. I did include a lot of under-21s, and a lot of people don't know them. And I know a few of them are going to be released anyway. But, you know, you end up with a hardcore 25 players there, and you look at the squad, if that's the squad that stayed, add another 5 or 6 experienced, good quality championship players, and I still think we've got a squad good enough to challenge for promotion next year. We've got a good hardcore squad, I think, but it needs supplementing with that extra bit of quality. And so, yeah, the biggest shock for me was Ruiz maybe not getting near a 50% and Ambrosetta's results easily. And then on the loans, Fofana, people would like to see him back, Turner, and then the rest, okay, we don't know about Guthrie, we don't know about Husband.
Right.
Third, want Richards. I mean, personally, I don't want Richards to come back. I'm gutted he's injured tomorrow, obviously. And so, yeah, I'd like to see Fofana come back next year, full season loan. He gives us something different. And I think he's played really well on a couple of occasions recently, and I'd like to see him start tomorrow. So it was an interesting survey, and, yeah, there were some decent results. But really the headline one, which, to be honest, I think because I did the finance survey, the finance article as well, was really the Simons vote. And
yeah.
no one, it didn't really get picked up and taken along. And in a way, I'm glad, because I didn't want to make a big thing about it.
Well, we are now, Mike.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I think that maybe a lot of people are just resigned to the fact that he's not going to get the job. So, you know, you've got to think he's got to win 5 or 6 of the last 7 to even get a chance.
Well, I think it's important. I think these last 7 matches are extremely important to the future of Keith Simons. I think he has to win, like you mentioned. I think he has to win a good amount of these matches. So I'm not going to disagree with you there, Mike. One thing that stands out to me before I get David's take is was the loans, and I was curious that Fofana, like you mentioned, came in at almost 80%. Turner came in at almost 72%, which is pretty impressive. And then you go down the list, you know. But another, you know, again, I was a little bit surprised that Stafelidis came in so low at 38%, but very, very interesting poll. Very interesting. I'm glad that you did it. You haven't done one in a while, so it was nice that you did this and you know gave us food for thought here, Dave. And now over to you, David. I'm sorry. What are your thoughts about Mike's survey and the results from it?
I'm not surprised about Kit, really. To be honest with you, because I mean, I can honestly hold my hands up and say that I was never struck on him being appointed from day one, as you know, and there's others like that. So, but obviously people have been very disappointed what's happened. You know, the unfortunate thing for Kit, it's been all downhill since he was appointed manager. When he was caretaker, everything went well for him. We had this great run. But literally the same time as he was appointed manager, I think that's when we got beaten by Derby at home in the cup or something like that. And it's just, there hasn't really been a run. And, you know, he's failed to move on. He's failed to build on that initial promising start. And there's been questions about his selection and his tactics and substitutions and everything else. And so, for me and many others, he just isn't the right man to take us forward, unfortunately, based on what we've seen. And it's a shame, but I think, you know, we've had an awful season overall, and that, you know, wasn't helped by our start, but it hasn't really improved that much. So I can see that totally. I mean, in terms of the results, I think the fullbacks are always going to be in the firing line a bit because of the narrow system we play and the pressure they've been under. Some of this is a bit unfair, but some of it also is, you know, I've expected a lot more from Stafleidis, to be honest with you. I thought he was going to be this all singing, all dancing, attacking left back. He was going to get forward and get crosses in and bang a few shots in as well, but hasn't really happened. And again, maybe the narrow system hasn't helped, that we have a lot of pressure down the wings, which is difficult to get forward. Otherwise, I'm not really surprised there. I'm glad to see that it's not just me that doesn't rate Brian Ruiz either. Because, you know, we've been accused of being too anti-Ruiz on this show, and I would level out and say we're too pro-Ruiz on this show, really, and that would be backed up by this thing that, you know, more than 2-1 don't think that he should be here. Okay, it's an easy thing to say when you know that 99.9% he's leaving anyway. So, that's just sort of an obvious bet to make. But I think, in the main, most of the results were fairly straightforward. There weren't big shocks for me. So I'm not shocked on the Kit one. I'm not really shocked on anything else. Amabesh, I suppose, yes, you would say that the tide has turned against him massively compared to what you thought it would be, because, you know, we've been waiting for weeks and weeks for him and Hoogland to come back into the team to save our defence and our season, and it just didn't really happen like that. And Ashley Richards, yes, I share Mike's disappointment on that one as well. I heard that he could actually be out for a while, so I'm sure Mike will be even more disappointed about that. So, yeah, he hasn't done anything for me, Richards. I think we need to look elsewhere in that respect. I guess if Kit's not here, that may be the case. If Kit is here, you could see him probably trying to sign him.
Interesting. Very interesting take by both of you on Mike's survey. And again, please do go to vivaelfulham.co.uk and you will see Mike's survey. Very interesting. Real great data there, Mike. And it's going to lead me to go on to your article. And I have to tell you, I enjoyed your article. I got so much out of it. It's difficult because we could actually spend probably an hour or two just talking about this because you really took your time and went through the finances of Fulham starting all the way back in the 2005-2006 season. The article, again, also on vivaelfulham.co.uk, is called Fulham, A Financial Look at What Went Wrong. And, Mike, I was thinking about reading the conclusion, but I thought it might be best just because to really give a flavor exactly what you were going through when you were writing this, just to hand it over to you and just share with everyone. If they haven't read it, you know, basically summarize what your article was all about.
Yeah, cheers, Russ. Well, it came out of, I was trying to write about financial fair play, but it's such a difficult subject to pin down because the rules keep changing. So what I did was I decided to go back, and I've always had this theory that the summer of 2013 was where it all really went wrong, and I had a background on the finances for a while, and I just thought I'd put it all together, going back to Coleman's days, to show how the club had grown, how we did, you know, with Europa years, and you know, at the end of 2013 season, we've got the accounts up to then. So I showed how our wages have gone up, how our turnover has increased, but also really was about why we got relegated, why weren't we buying the right players, and when you look at it, the wages we were paying through the nose for experienced players, and this is what I was trying to get at. because if you look at other clubs and their finances, you know, our wages are always mid-table in the Premier League for about the last 6 or 7 years. So we were paying, you know, London prices, if you like. And also we had a ground which, as I showed in the survey, was full. We couldn't squeeze any more in. We couldn't get any more money out of it. So we were just going stagnant and living off the TV money. And so what I tried to show was that we'd reached a point where we had no sellable assets, which was the players, because they were all 30-plus, and that we had no money, or no money was being invested to buy younger players, like take Dembele, for example. You pay $5 million, buy, you know, 2 years later, you sell him for 15. Now, that's not going to happen all the time, but then there's other things like you don't spend $10 million on one player, you buy three players for $10 million. Okay, you're gambling, but one or two of them might work instead of one flopping. So we were paying. The conclusion I've come to is that we were living beyond our means, and we gambled over the last couple of years to stay up. Because if you start looking, it's all coming out now in the last few weeks. Even today, Crystal Palace, they made £20-odd million last year profit. And because last year's TV money was so high, the Premier League teams are suddenly, blimey, we're making a profit. And we're a club that's made a couple of million here, lost a bit here. We've been sustainable, that word, for a while. But we've not been able to grow, and we've not been able to keep the team fresh with younger players, or certainly mid-20 players, which is what we needed. So really, that's the conclusion I came to, is we just reached a point where it just went bust and we hadn't invested properly, and we were living beyond our means.
Listen, this was an excellent article, Mike. Seriously, I had to read it a couple of times because I kept getting something else out of it. And one of the things I got out of it, I want to mention this to you before I go to David, was, you know, again, something that I've always harped on, Dembele and Dempsey, the money from that. And talk about, you know, because, again, I at the time I'm like, well, why didn't we invest the money from that? What where did that money go to? And you actually have a very interesting conclusion of where that money went. Why don't you share that with us?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an argument that everyone goes on about. We got £22 million and we didn't spend it. Well, we did spend it because our wages were going up between 6 and 17% every year. You know, I mean, the year after the Europa Cup final, our wages went up 17%. And so in the summer after Dembele and Dempsey left, we had made some purchases. Our wages went up again. And that money is used to just keep the club going. And the one thing you do when you look at the accounts is there is no investment. So there's no owner putting in £20 million or £10 million into the business. They're writing the cash flow off as a debt, but they're not actually putting any money back in. So the fact is, we made $10 million on Dembele, but we didn't use the money properly. All we did was to pay for all those older players again, their wages. So
right.
When you're looking at, you know, and so I go back to 2013, and you look at Parker, who's on a 3.5-year deal, 40K a week roughly, cost 3 million quid. His whole contract and everything is £10 million. We've spent £10 million over 3.5 years on a player who was 32 when we signed him. And that's the kind of madness that we found ourselves in that particular summer. So, yeah, sorry, going back to the season after Dembele, it was spent. It was spent on the wrong players, but it was spent mainly on wages and just keeping the club going.
That's what I found fascinating about this article, because you really, you know, like I said, the detail that you put into this, Mike, and really shed light on things that have been bothering me. And, you know, like you said, you go back to that summer of 2013, and I'm glad that you went back there, because it's something we've talked about on the show, but to have the financial data that you shared was just, a revelation for me. So I would recommend everyone going to vivaelfulham.co.uk and reading this excellent article by Mike Gregg. I couldn't recommend it any higher. I put it on the Clutter Talk Facebook page along with your survey, but I just want to recommend it one more time to everyone. David, what are your thoughts about Mike's article?
Well, it's impossible to go through it, obviously, in detail here. And to be honest with you, I can't remember all the detail anyway, because I did read it at the very start. But I found it fascinating and very, yeah, very in-depth and a good analysis. And I think some of it is maybe obvious, and some of it is a little bit scary as well, that, you know, we're supposedly a club that we looked after our finances very well, and, you know, we were prudent. But it kind of, on the other hand, almost is a bit of a damnation of almost of the, you know, of the regime to say that we were just living for today and not for tomorrow. And I think, you know, it was, the writing was certainly on the wall as regards to relegation. And, you know, I've said that it started a long way back, and I think that this kind of backs that up. It's not necessarily, you can't really put your finger on it exactly, but the trend in the main, obviously, was negative. And, you know, and the big factor was that we had a very settled team for a long time, but they were getting older, and we weren't integrating new players in, and we weren't reinvesting the money. The money was reinvested just to pay wages and everything else. And because we reached the glass ceiling of the capacity at Craven Cottage more or less every year, there wasn't any way to get more money in, bar obviously the TV money. And you know, the whole system is just ridiculous. That there's more and more TV money, and it just ends up going out on wages. And someone needs to do something before football becomes very bankrupt, I think, because it's you know, we've seen some big clubs fall from grace already. You know, Leeds are maybe on their way back, thankfully, but you know, Wolves had a bad spell. Look at poor old Portsmouth as well. Not that we like them, but I don't think you want to see anything like that happen to another club, because it could be you tomorrow and it could be us. I mean, if we get relegated this year, it could be us still. Because already I think, even just to maintain the status quo, our season ticket sales are going to be rubbish for next season. I can really see that. You know, home shirts are now down to £10. I know there's going to be a new one next year, but I don't think anyone particularly liked them that much this year. They're giving them away now. I mean, season tickets, they're going to have to bribe people to buy season tickets next year, I think. I mean, all the old mugs and hearty souls like me, yeah, we'll be buying them. Of course we will. But I think a lot of people won't bother renewing because, A, they haven't been impressed with the football the last couple of years, and B, they know that we're not going to be sold out or anything like sold out, so you'll be able to get a ticket for a game anyway.
Yeah.
So that means the club are going to have even worse cash flow situation at the start of next season, I would imagine. I'm sure Mike would agree with this as well. I've seen so much debate on Twitter about people saying they're not going to renew, or they expect there to be a big discount, and I think there should. But is it prudent for the club to do that? Will the club give a big discount to existing season ticket holders and say, right, you know, you've been loyal with us, we're going to give you a big discount for next year? Probably not, because they need the money. So
yeah,
and this is a kind of a vicious circle we've got ourselves into. And
it is.
Once again, we are going to be forced to flush people out, get rid of anyone on a high wage, more or less. And that means, you know, there's no guarantee next season will be successful either. And that could be another season of rebuilding. And then, you know, the cycle continues. So, you know, it's very unfortunate, but, you know, it's good that Mike's been able to break it down, and so you can actually have a look and see the different aspects to it and where things started to go wrong.
Yeah. You know, again, he diagnosed in detail with financial data where things went wrong. And that's what I appreciated when I went through this entire thing. And it was painful, you know, to read, Mike. Not about your just reading your data. I'm talking about, you know, as a fan, it was painful to
yeah.
see it, because it was like, oh, it's right in front of you when you see, you know, when you see the results and you see the finances, you see how it all went wrong. And it's you know, it was painful to read, but I have to say this, and again, I know I'm praising you a great deal, but you have to understand this. As a fan of sports here in America, I'm used to articles like this in the Boston Globe, in the New York Times, in major publications, Sports Illustrated. This piece that you wrote deserves to be in something like the Boston Globe. Or Sports Illustrated. It's that good. So, again, you know,
thank
I just want
much,
to mention that. It was that detailed. I mean, I was so impressed by the time and effort and the data. I just, again, thank you, Mike, for writing that. That's all.
Well, thanks very much, Russ. And yeah, I've had really good feedback, and I'm really proud of it. And
you should be.
There will be another one when the accounts come out any day now, which will be for last season. And,
right.
I look forward
to your analysis of that.
Well, I think we're all going to have a shock when we see how much wages we paid last year. So,
okay.
And I know you have a Derby. I know you follow Derby, Russ.
Yeah.
Well, they did their accounts for last year. So what did they do last year? They got to the playoff final. They're in the championship. Their wages were $13.5 million. Our wages last year would have been $75 million, probably.
Oh.
So that's the kind of cutbacks you need to do when you're in the championship.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, because that's what Andy Buckley Taylor told me. You know, he said you have to cut the wages, and you just nailed it.
Yeah, and that's what we did last summer. And this summer, when we go into the new year, we lose $5 million straight away through the parachute payments. So when we talk about this coming season, this summer, it's the one year where we have an advantage on the other clubs who are in the championship at the moment, because let's remember, there's going to be three clubs coming down who are going to get a bucket load of money, and they've only gone up for one year. So apart from QPR, the other two teams, you know, they've done some dodgy stuff on their finances. But really, I do see next season as I would swear, but it's something and bust to get promotion, because we will have still have the financial advantage over the other teams.
I agree with that, Mike. You know, because that's why I'm all geared up for this summer, because I just think it's so important. I think there's an opportunity there, and you are basically describing the opportunity, and that's what's interesting here is that the financial opportunity for us to do it is really this upcoming summer. You know, and that's part of the reason why I'm so excited and nervous at the same time about next season. We're not there yet, but again, I'm looking forward to speaking more about it. I'm looking forward to your sobering next article. We'll just leave it at that. Let's move on, guys. Let's now go to the Qatar controversy roundtable. And David, I'm going to start with you. I just brought you back online. I posed these two questions on the Qatar Facebook page. The first one is, does it mean more to you for Fulham to be Brentford or QPR when they have the chance to play both? And obviously, we're not playing QPR right now. We're only playing Brentford. So I pose that to the Qatar Talk Facebook page. Got some interesting answers. I want your answer on that, David. Is it QPR or Brentford?
I'm not going to lower myself into this, because for me, it's important to win every game, really. And I don't want to start point scoring, petty point scoring. You know, hopefully I've grown up beyond that a little bit. Of course, it's good to beat your local rivals, whoever they be, whether it be Brentford, QPR, or the other team in Fulham, obviously. But to pair one off against the other, I don't know, really. I mean,
okay.
I guess from a simplistic point of view, it's better to beat QPR, because that means at this stage we would be at a Premier League level. But I guess, you know, for us, it's just important to be winning all matches against, you know, opposition and local rivals, whoever we're playing. So, I mean, on this occasion, it's Brentford, but on another occasion, it'll be QPR. On another occasion,
okay,
it'll be you-know-who.
Okay, again, it was kind of just an interesting subject I came up with. I was just curious what the fans thought. I figured it was one over the other, but I thought I would ask it anyways. Mike, I'm curious your thoughts on this. Do you agree with David, who wants to abstain from it, or is there one or the other that you would want Fulham to beat more?
Well, I think it's a generation thing. That depends on how old you were and when you started watching Fulham. If it was in the 80s, then Brentford would be the rivals. If it was in the 70s, it would have been QPR. And the other team, there's a pecking order. There's the other team, there's QPR, and then there's Brentford. And so I'd always want us to beat QPR.
So for you, it's
before Brentford.
You would always house me QPR.
You know. Yeah, Brentford are the team you throw your rubbish out at as you're leaving, going along the M4 Westway when you're leaving London. So,
you know, it's funny because I was listening to a Brentford podcast. I could just tell they're pretty sensitive. I'm talking about at least the podcast that I was listening to. They're confident about this upcoming match tomorrow, but I could tell that they have this little chip on their shoulder. I'm not sure if that's how all Brentford supporters feel, but I know that they're bringing a huge amount of supporters tomorrow. But it's interesting. I was just curious what everyone thought about this, you know, between QPR and Brentford. And let me just get to it because I want to pull up what I came up with. I'm going to read these and just get your thoughts on it real quick. Then we'll move to number two. Trucker Dave said QPR. Roger Lewis said QPR. Ben Reed. Beating QPR 6-0 was incredibly satisfying. James Dowden has to be the QP ha-has. Chris Cox at QPR. Eton Redurb said QPR. And Stephen O'Keefe, Brentford are getting big for their boots, but credit when it's due. I fancy us to win for some reason. I apply pressure on Brentford. I hope still want us to win this badly. So that's what Stephen O'Keefe had to say. So basically, guys, it looks like, for the most part, again, I only have about a half a dozen responses. It's like most of them are QPR. Okay, let's move on to this second Cottage Talk Facebook question. Again, I'm just going through the different positions. Eventually, we're going to get to an all-time starting 11. But, Mike, I'll start with you. Who have been the two best center backs you have seen wear a Fulham shirt? I thought originally about doing basically a pair of center backs, but then I thought, no, I'm not going to do a pair. We're going to do just the two best center backs you have seen.
Yes, it was a tough one, and spent a little bit of time thinking about it. And I'm going to look back, and I'm going to say one of them is a player called Roger Brown, who was a big, long, blue-eyed centre back in the early '80s, led us to promotion from what is League One now, and proper traditional number five. Gets in where it hurts, and not the best player in the world. Certainly wouldn't be able to compete today at the level we're at. But, yeah, Roger Brown for me is one of them. And then we've had other players like, you know, David, we remember Doug the Fug, Doug Rugby. He only played 17 games for us, but he was inspirational in a playoff season we had. And, you know, almost single-handedly got us there, really. But, you know, I don't want to go into it too much. We've had Coleman, we've had Simons, but let's be honest here, it's Hanglund is the other one, you know, but you could almost argue it's got to be Hanglund and Hughes, because Hanglund's never the same player when Hughes wasn't his right-hand man. But, yeah, for me, it's Roger Brown and Hanglund, and I'm not going to look much further than that.
Okay, fantastic. And honestly, I was thinking about, you know, when I was thinking about the pair, I'm like, okay, you know, I wanted to stay away from the Hanglund Hughes thing. So I thought, okay, let's just talk about two center backs. I hear what you're saying about that. It's very interesting because I got very different pairings here, which is, well, I shouldn't say pairings, just two different center backs, and you just gave me two. David, how about you? Again, you have a long history. Who are the two best center backs you've seen?
Well, those two that Mike mentioned are certainly going to be up there for me as well. When I first started, the one that first stood out for me was John Lacey, and he was one of our centre-backs in our run to the Cup Final in 75. But you're going to have a look at who he played alongside as well, and although he was not in his youngest days, he was coming towards the end of his career. You know, we had none other than, you know, the World Cup winning captain Bobby Moore in our side. And
yep.
He was a fantastic player, and, you know, perhaps on history alone, he has to be considered as one of the best. And, I mean, even for Fulham, you know, he was a great player for Fulham. Perhaps he wasn't quite at his peak, obviously, but he was fantastic for Fulham. And after that, of course, our friend who's been on the show, of course, Tony Gale, another fantastic player. Very, very clever footballer, really, for his time. You know, in those days of centre-halves often being hoof merchants, Gale was, you know, the natural successor, really, to Bobby Moore in a way, although he never achieved the same heights as Bobby Moore. He was a centre-back that could play the ball, He was a cultured player. He took a lot of our set pieces, scored a lot of set pieces, free kicks on the edge of the area. That's something we could do with today, really. And then latterly, of course, Gael, he was paired with Roger Brown. And Roger Brown, you know, for his heart and his spirit and everything, you know, he got in where it hurt. Technically, he wasn't probably that great, but doing the simple things, you know, heading, clearing the ball, getting in tough, yeah, he was a great player. And then it's hard, really, after that to kind of to jump on anyone. I mean, I like Mark Blake in our Mickey Adam days because
okay.
he was our penalty taker, and he was a great penalty taker, and I thought he did a good job for us. And then, of course, we had the Welsh trio, Melville, Colville, and Simons, of course, and they do. Coleman was a great player, but his career was cut short, obviously. Melville, underrated, I think, got a lot of stick, but, you know, he was a good player. And then, really, as you look at the Hanglin and Hughes pairing, and often I wonder who was really the better player. And you look at the discipline that Aaron Hughes showed. He was rarely booked. He was often the one who did the man marking, where Hanglin was slightly more freer. And Hanglin got the plaudits because he scored the goals, because sometimes he ventured more forward. But without Hughes, I don't know, perhaps he wasn't the same player without Aaron Hughes. So it's difficult to split those two, whether you can actually pick one without the other. And, you know, I was impressed with what Aaron Hughes brought to the side. Perhaps
so
at first he didn't get much recognition, maybe at first, and it was when Hanglin came into the team that we did find the perfect pairing there. We really did. But for me, I think because of who they were and what they brought to the team, especially in my younger days, I'm going to go for the late, great Bobby Moore and Tony Gale.
Very interesting, David. And what's interesting is that the comments I'm about to read, Gale's mentioned, Bobby Moore is mentioned, Aaron Hughes is mentioned, Bretta is obviously mentioned, Roger Brown is mentioned. Many names here, which I found fascinating. That's why I'm glad I did this, that I've been doing this, because, again, you know, I'm a Fulham supporter only from 2007. I am starving for more information about the past. That's why I'm so glad to have you guys on and sharing your stories. It helps me because I was not around for that, and I want to learn. And hearing these names and learning these stories are fantastic for me personally. So thank you guys for sharing your thoughts on it. I'm going to share what the Fulham supporters had to say. Let's start with John Agger. He said, Chris Coleman and Bretta Hanglin. Trucker Dave, Bretta and Boca, meaning Carlos Bocanegra. Kevin James, Bretta Hanglin and Bobby Moore. Alan Hammersley, Roger Braun, Chris Coleman. Ben Reed, in my time it's Bretta and Aaron Hughes. Roger Warren, Dave Roberts and John Dempsey. Chris Jones, Coleman and Hanglin for me. Graham Gurr, Coleman and Hanglin for me too. Chris Cox, Bretta Hanglin and Roger Braun. Jamie De Havilland, Terry Angus and Glenn Thomas. Barry Porter, Coleman and Hanglin. I figured that. Okay, so Prashad Patel, Aaron Hughes and Bretta Hanglin, followed by Tony Gale and Roger Braun. Stuart Lover, for me, it would be between Bretta Hanglin, Chris Coleman, John Dempsey, and Roy Bentley. Eton Red Derp says, since I've been following, it has to be Bretta and Hughes. Okay, let's see what else we got here. Alex Sainor, Hanglin and Coleman for me, too. Though Hughes could well be better than Coleman, it's just that Coleman's career was curtailed, and we didn't see him against the best, but he was immense. Dean Rozier, Goma or Coleman and Hughes or Hanglin for me. Okay, and that's going to do it. David, you had a little bit of a chuckle. Share your chuckle with me.
Well, I assume the Terry Angus and Glenn Thomas were a jokey. I loved actually Terry Angus. He was, you know, a great, again, you know, honest pro who played for us in, you know, perhaps our slightly darker days. And Glenn Thomas, likewise, who probably was a promising youngster who got a bit big for his boots, I think, because I remember him calling the shots when Don Mackay was a manager, which is obviously the wrong way around. So they were both reasonable players, but not up there. But, I mean,
sure.
It's hard to pick. I think you've got to pick Hanglin and Hughes as a single entity. I don't think you can pick one without the other. So that's why I decided not to pick both of them, because I did want Bobby Moore to be in there. But
right.
if you can call Hanglin and Hughes a single entity, then yeah, I think they're in there. But I don't think Breda is good without Hughes, and I don't think Hughes is as good without Breda. So, you know, make what you want of that.
Listen, I totally agree with you, and that was part of the challenge here, because like I said, originally I was going to post it as a pairing, and I thought, no, I'm going to do it as just two separate center backs, and let's see what everyone says, and that's what made this fascinating and interesting. So I'm actually glad I did it this way, but yes, it's almost like one person with Hanglin and Hughes. Very, very good point by you, David. All right, guys, let's move on to our preview of the match tomorrow. I'm very much looking forward to it. Unfortunately, we'll be listening. You guys will be there. So, you know, again, I'm very much looking forward to this match. Let's start with Brentford. They're currently seventh. In their last six matches, just so you know, they've won two, they've drawn two, and they've lost two. So they're pretty, you know, pretty steady here. They have 20 wins on the season. They have six draws and 13 losses. They've scored 64. They've given up 52 for a goal differential of a positive 12, and points they are on 66. Like I said, they are 7th. Fulham are currently 20th. We have 12 wins, 7 draws, 20 losses. We've scored 50. We've given up 68 for minus 18, and a point total of 43. Players to watch in this match for Brentford include Andre Gray, leading goal scorer with 14. Alex Pritchard is another player you need to watch. He's a midfielder with 9 goals, and a player that controls the play for them in central midfield is Jonathan Douglas. He also has scored 7 goals. So, again, that's just a little information on Brentford. Their manager is Paul Warburton, who's done an excellent job with this team getting them to 7. They have to give him credit for where they are. And I will start with you, Mike. What are your thoughts about Brentford's season and the championship this year?
Well, they've certainly done better than I expected them to. I think a lot of it is momentum from getting promotion, and they certainly play the game in quite an exciting way. Very similar to Bournemouth, probably with a little bit less skill, but, you know, with the two wide men attacking. We've played them twice, and they've made good accounts of themselves, and they're a very dangerous team, and it's going to be hard for us tomorrow. Even though Warburton is leaving, their form, although a little bit mixed in the 8 games since he left there, you know, as you said, they've won 2, drawn 2, lost 2 in the last 6. But they're still hanging in, and they're still up there. And they're going to be bringing a lot of fans tomorrow, and we will have to be at our best. We're going to have to be like the Derby game, you know, that kind of commitment. But I've been impressed by him and Warburton. I'm not entirely sold on him. I think he was given a good team, and okay, he's made it a bit better. But I think Rosler did a lot of the hard work. So for him, I know a lot of fans are quite keen on him joining us in the summer, and that would be a complete, you know, let's build a new team for promotion. Now, I'm not convinced he's the right person for that, but it's a very odd situation down there. But I think they're going to hang in. I think they're going to get in the playoffs. And, you know, good luck to them, really, even though they are our rivals. And, you know, let's see what happens. But, so, yeah, I've been overall impressed with them.
Okay, very, very good, Mike. And listen, you know, you got to give them credit. I didn't give them much credit at the beginning of the season. I didn't think that they'd be where they are. So you have to give them credit. They deserve it. They've had a great season, very good comparison to Bournemouth. This is an attacking side. I listened to a podcast today, you know, again, really talked about how that they plan on coming to Craven Cottage to attack. That's who they are. They're going to come to attack, and Mike, you mentioned that as well. Before I go to David, I want to ask you about one thing that I read. I read a very interesting article about analytics involved with Brentford, and that might be a factor in what's going on with Warburton. Have you heard anything about this? I read a very interesting article dealing with the chairman and his team in Denmark.
Yes, so basically he's a bookie, or he does something. It's very analytical anyway. And he wants to have a director of football and a coach next year. And a lot of it is going to work with the same system of this team in Denmark, where it's all about stats for picking players and, you know, signing players. And and Warburton has said no, he's not interested in that, which is quite interesting considering he was a director of football at Brentford before becoming manager, so obviously doesn't like it now he's a manager. But yeah, the chairman obviously has his ideas on how things should work. It's an interesting way, and you know, analytics in football is still, you know, still frowned upon. You know, you have the Moneyball stuff in baseball and all the other sports now, and you know, Liverpool tried it with a couple of years ago with their signings. It didn't work too great, but yeah, I mean, it seems to be working for this team in Denmark, but the real test will be over here in the Championship, and you know, I'll be interested to see how it works, because we underuse stats in football. You can overuse them, but we underuse them at the moment.
Right. Right. What was interesting, and again, reading this article, fascinating article, to be honest with you. I believe it was in The Guardian, and it was talking about analytics and, you know, using stats, and you were talking about picking the players, you know who to start and who to purchase. But what it also was interesting to talk about this team in Denmark, that they would pass on these stats at halftime before the manager would give the halftime talk. You know, again, so the stats would be used at halftime to maybe dictate what the manager would do for the second half. I found that interesting. You know, again, I think you should use whatever you need, you know, to help you win a match. And if stats help you, why not have that as part of your arsenal of different things to use to win a match? So I'm not against analytics. To be honest with you, that's what I found interesting. I'm not against this at all. I just find it interesting that this is the direction possibly that Brentford are going in. All right, David, over to you. I want to get your thoughts on Brentford.
Well, I kind of agree with what's been said already. I mean, let's not have sour grapes about it. You know, they've done really well, much better than we've expected. And you know, and full credit to them. And
absolutely.
The annoying thing, though, is that they're a team with, you know, a fraction of our resources, apparently, by comparison, and look how well they've done. So, you know, you've got to look back at yourself and say, well, is this a team who are doing better than expected? Or is this how well, you know, you can do? Is this, you know, and it smacks for us that we've really, like, made a right old balls up of things again. Because we've got, you know, we've got much more in terms of the resort. We've got bigger crowds, we've got more money, we've got a richer owner. And we're struggling to get off, you know, the foot of the table hardly. And they've done really well. They're playing much better football than we've been playing. You know, they've made it look so simple. And we've made it look so difficult, haven't we? We've really, really struggled. And it's not about them. We're talking about Brentford, I know. But look how well they've done. And, yeah, I think there is a likeness to maybe what Bournemouth have done as well. And so it's not just a flash in the pan. You know, they've got a couple of teams with you know, limited resources by comparison, done really well and played fast, exciting football. And we haven't. So, obviously, I think they're right and we're wrong, really. But, you know, we've got to be careful of them. And, you know, I've heard talk that we've had a look at Warburton, or we've spoke to Warburton with a view to him coming to us. And for me, he's a complete unknown, because I knew nothing about him until he suddenly popped up at Brentford. And then, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe the groundworks were done by Uwe Rosler before that. I don't know. But he certainly carried them on in a pretty good way. And it's very mind-boggling that the way Brentford have treated him, you know. You know, we're here, you know, hanging on to a manager and saying, yeah, he has our support. And we're struggling to sort of be out of the relegation zone. And they're, like, struggling not to be in the top six. And they said, all right, at the end of the season, you're on your way, mate, you know. Doesn't seem very much, you know, very kind way to treat someone who's done really well for you, regardless of whether that's because he inherited a good team or because of his own work. But,
right.
Yeah, we're going to have to watch out for them. But I suppose in one way, if they're going to come at us, it's good because, you know, maybe it'll give us an opportunity as well, rather than, you know, in the past, teams have seen that, you know, when we play our diamond, they can just sit back and crowd the midfield and catch us on the break. So, you know, it might work. And of course, interestingly, we actually beat them under Felix McGath. You know,
yes, we did.
Kit couldn't do, but Felix managed to beat them. So, okay, maybe that was a lucky result. Maybe, I don't know what it was, but we beat them. So, okay. Perhaps there is a way through tomorrow.
Well, we shall see, David. And listen, just for time's sake, I did have the audio clip from Kip, but I'm not going to play it for today, just because, again, just for time reasons. But just a couple things before we go on, and I get some information for you about the ref. Kip did mention in his presser that Ross McCormack and Scott Parker should be available for selection. It doesn't mean that they will be, but they should be available for selection, and that Jazz Richards is injured and should not be available for selection. Those were the latest, and that also Lasse Vigen Christensen was back in training, but again, it doesn't sound like he's got a proper timetable of when he's going to return. But it is a good sign that he is back with the squad. So that's just a little information there. David, over to you. Let's talk about the ref for this match tomorrow.
Well, they've picked Simon Hooper. It'll be his third Fulham game this season. Previous two have been, you know, good for us because we've won both of them 2-1. So if he can carry on that run, that'll be great. The only thing was, both of them have been away. He ref the match at Birmingham and also the one at Brighton away. And I was at Birmingham. I think Mike was at Brighton. And as far as I'm concerned, he did a good job at Birmingham, and I think he did a good job at Brighton as well. So I'm not disappointed with this appointment. I guess any ref where you've won a game, you're happy to have him back again. So I think he's one of the younger, up-and-coming ones as well. So, yeah, I'm not upset about this one. Could have been much worse.
Okay, very good. Very interesting there, David. Thank you for sharing the information about the ref tomorrow. All right, Mike, I'm going to go to you first. I always ask this. What do Fulham need to do to win this match, my friend?
Sorry, Russell was struggling there.
That's okay, Mike.
Yeah, well, we have to win. We're going to be struggling tomorrow, I think, to be perfectly honest. We need to play like we did against Derby. We're going to need to be on it straight away. Otherwise, it's going to be like Bournemouth, because that's the way they play with the wide men. And if we go in with a diamond, we're going to get slaughtered again. It doesn't matter who the loanies are or whoever plays at full-back. We're just not equipped to play that way. So it's a question of, what kind of formation he puts out. What I hope he doesn't do is flood the team with all the defensive players he had in the last game. Okay, we won the game, but I was speaking to someone who went to it and hardly got out of half, and I watched the replay, and that was true as well. So we're at home. It's going to be a big crowd. You know, we need to be a bit adventurous at least and take the game to them. And it's the same old thing, Russ. We can't let them score first, because we just struggle every time we let a goal in first.
Absolutely, Mike. I couldn't agree with you more. Let me ask you before I go to David, because you brought up the Derby County match and the Bournemouth match. Why did it work against Derby County and it did not work against Bournemouth for Fulham?
Because we weren't on it. The commitment wasn't there fully from every player, and also silly mistakes by players and the changes to the defence as well. It was just a combination of the factors. I mean, he's chopping and changing the team so much as well now, and just trying to find a combination. He found it last game, but it was a dire-looking team. And I personally don't want us to win games that way. I know some people, it's the result is everything, but I wouldn't want to watch that every week, I have to be honest. But, the difference was his commitment. We just haven't got
commitment.
The players.
Okay.
Yeah, we haven't got the players to match these teams, so we have to make up for it in another way.
Okay. So for you, it really is just getting on top of them and committing all over the pitch like they did against Derby County and not let them play. And we let Bournemouth play. They cannot let Brentford play. They got to stop them and then go forward from there. Don't let them play. That's what we said about Derby County. Don't let them play. They didn't. So that's why I wanted to ask you the difference. And I thought part of that was commitment, so I'm glad that you mentioned that. David, what is the key for you? What do Fulham need to do to win this match, my friend?
We've got to take the game to them. There's no point in sitting back and trying to catch them out or let them play. Don't let them play. Take the game to them. Win the battle in midfield. And I think we need to be stronger on the wings as well to try and counteract their play. So it's the age-old argument again. We need to be strong in the middle and we need to be strong on the wings. So, you know, with a diamond, we can be stronger in the middle but not on the wings. With a 4-4-2, perhaps the other way around a bit. We've got to find that balance of both. So I think, you know, something like a 4-4-1-1 kind of scenario maybe might be the way forward. I doubt Kit will do that, but that's what I would be going with.
Let me just throw it. If you went with a 4-4-1-1, I'm assuming you're talking about McCormack and behind Smith.
You might be right. You'll have to wait until I give my team.
Okay, David. All right. Well, going right back to you. Who's your key player for Fulham in this match?
I think it's a midfield battle. So once again, we need Scott Parker to lead by example, like he did against Derby. We've talked about that already, I know. But he was the key for me against Derby. He drove us forward. You know,
yep.
he never gave them a moment's rest. He unsettled their play, and they never recovered from it. So Scott Parker to come back in the team and to show what it means to win a local derby.
Okay. I think that's an excellent choice. Mike, do you agree with David or do you have someone else in mind?
I don't want to be boring, but yeah, I would agree with David. Parker is key. He is the captain and he sets the standard and other players have to match it. But the one player who will have to keep up with him and show the same commitment will probably be Tunnicliffe. He can't have one of his games where he disappears. So if he's partnering Parker in the middle, then he has to be at that standard as well.
Okay, very, very good point for mentioning him, you know, because it's not just about, I agree with you, it's not just about Scott Parker. You need the people around him to have that same type of commitment. We're going back to that commitment word. I agree with you, Mike, going back to that, because if we don't see that early, that's not a good sign. They need to be on top of them from the get-go of this match. If they're not, then it could be another Bournemouth situation, which I certainly don't want to see. I don't want you guys to see. All right, Mike, I'm going to go to you first. Give me your starting 11 for tomorrow.
Okay, so my starting 11, I would go
yours.
I would go with Betts, obviously, in goal. My back four would be Grimmer, Turner, Byrne, Kavanagh. Then central midfield, I would have Parker and Tunnicliffe. And I would go Roberts on one wing, Fofana on the other. So it would be four, a bank of four. I know Fofana's not a winger really, but he's done well recently. And then up front, I would actually go with McCormack and Woodrow. So
wow.
I suspect I probably only got about five players right to what will actually start tomorrow. Because I don't think it's going to be
anything
like that.
That's an interesting starting 11.
Yeah.
Let's see how many you actually do get right, Mike. That's very interesting. David, over to you with your starting 11.
As many as five, Mike, do you reckon? I don't know. Anyway, this is my team, not Kit's team, so, again, I'll probably be wrong, but I'm going to go for a slightly more conservative one that might get a few more players. So, Bettinelli in goal. I think we've got one there, probably, anyway. I'm going to put Hoogland back at right back.
Okay.
I'm going to have Bodiroff and Turner, and I'm going to give a debut to Husband because I don't think Cavan is very strong at left back, and Stafelidis, I don't know either. So, yeah, I think Husband's been brought into play, so I'm going to give him a debut because I want to see what he can do anyway. He might be awful, but there's no point bringing him here if we don't see what he can do. Right, midfield two, I'm going to go for Parker and Guthrie. Again, Guthrie's been brought to play. He seems very much up for it, so I want to see what he can do as well. I'm going to play right midfield. I'm going to play Tunnicliffe. He can play there. He'll provide, you know, hopefully a dual role into kind of protecting Hoogland. He can drop to right back if Hoogland goes forward. He can also go forward himself. We can double up on that wing. And on the left, I'm going to go for Kakaliklic, because we need to have someone with a bit of pace who can try and do something. I haven't been massively impressed with him, but then he scored against, you know, Huddersfield, I know, fortuitously. And we're going to need someone to provide, you know, width and service, and again to double up with Husband. He's not maybe the best player to sit back at left back if Husband goes forward. Kavanagh would probably be better, but we need to be a bit adventurous. And yes, you're completely right. Up front, Matt Smith and McCormack just sitting behind him.
Okay, very good. I like it. All right, David. I'm going to go back to you. I got your starting 11. I got Mike's starting 11. Now I'm going to go back to you and ask you, what do you think Kit's going to pick for his starting 11? So let's go back. I want you to predict what you think he's going to do. I know what you want to do. What do you think Kit's going to do for his starting 11?
I think the back five will be, as I said, I think Kit would pick Hoogland over Grimmer, and he will pick Bodiroff and Turner and Husband, I think. I fear we'll see in midfield. I think we'd probably see Guthrie and Tunnicliffe and Parker as a midfield three, and with Brian Ruiz, of course, sitting there in front, unless he decides Kakanicic. And I think we will see Smith and McCormack up front.
And McCormack.
So I don't think it's going to be that many different players to what I said. It's going to be the only different one would be, but actually it's almost the same team as I've picked.
Except
that
for Ruiz
instead of Kakanicic. But he could play Pat Kakanicic there, so it would be the same 11 as I've picked, but
okay.
He might not play. He may go back to his favourite diamond.
Okay, interesting. Mike, I want to give you a shot at it because, again, I it's not Felix bingo, but it's, you know, at times it kind of feels like it. So what do you think Kit's going to do tomorrow? I want you to predict his starting 11. Not your starting 11, his starting 11.
That was exactly the same as what Dave said. So Hoogland, Bodiroff, Turner, Husband, Guthrie, Parker, Tunnicliffe, Rooney, Smith, McCormick, and Bettinelli in goal. Yeah,
wow.
That's what I think
so
it
let's
will
see.
Be. Yeah.
Let's see how close you guys are. I'll be curious to see how close you guys are to picking, actually, Kit's starting 11. All right. All right, guys, let's go to predictions. I put up the predictions kind of late on the Colors Talk Facebook page, so I don't even think I got one, which is okay. So I will start with you, David. I'll give you first take at predictions. So predict this match tomorrow.
In blind faith that the referee's been lucky twice in a row, the ref's going to make it a hat-trick, and it's going to be 2-1 to Fulham.
2-1 to Fulham. Okay. Mike, over to you.
My heart says 3-1 win, but my head is saying a 3-1 loss.
Okay. So you...
I'm hedging my bet.
I understand that.
I fear the worst tomorrow if we're not up for it.
Well, that's what it all comes down to, Mike. And I'm glad that you put it that way. You know, again, it's about commitment. It's about being up for it. And it's a local derby, and they need to be up for it. They need to be up for it, like you mentioned, like that Derby County match. And I think the one thing that makes me nervous, going back to what you guys talked about, is the fact of new players coming in. You know, again, you know, shuffling the deck again. I mean, and I have a feeling that's going to happen. How quickly can that deck come together? You know, can everyone play as a team? And that's one of the advantages that Brentford has coming into this match, you guys will agree with me, is that these guys play together as a unit. That's the advantage that Bournemouth has. It's the advantage that Watford had. It's the advantage that Brentford has is the ability to really play together for a decent period of time that Fulham just don't have. It's not about talent. It's about playing together as a team and being committed, like you said, Mike. So
I'm
going to do is because – oh, I'm sorry, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we can just see it happening, can't you? Guthrie's played 2 games all season. So, yes, he starts tomorrow and looks unfit. Husband, he's hardly played any games. You're gonna
That's
have
the point I'm making, right.
At right. Yeah, you're going to have Hoogland at right back who hasn't looked, you know, David said he needs help in front of him. He's going to need another right back with him, you know, because he can't defend anyway. So if he picks that team, we're screwed.
Okay,
that's my
Mike.
Team. It's my team, right, as well.
All right. All right. Well,
exactly.
Well, again, that's why I'm glad that we can do this show. And you guys know me. I'm usually Mr. Positive. And after going through this show, guys, I'm not going to be Mr. Negative. I'm going to be Mr. Neutral. I'm going for a 1-1 draw. I'm going to go full. We're going to get a point out of this. And that it's going to be an entertaining game. And I would pick a victory, but I'm not going to because of the uncertainty of this lineup and new players coming in. You know, again, if the new players come in, like like Mike said, we could be screwed just because they haven't played together. You're going against a team that has played a great deal together. They're used to each other's movements, and that's what concerns me in this match. You know, it's not just about commitment, it's also about playing together. So that's why I'm going to go for the 1-1 draw. All right. All right, guys. Great show. Great show. David, you are excellent as always, my friend. Thank you for joining me. I miss talking to you.
That's very kind of you to say. Very kind. There's always that Skype button, you know. You can always click on there and say hello if you miss me that much. But it's been great, and obviously we've got a few matches coming up, and I don't know, I haven't seen the schedule yet, but I assume we'll be back to discuss Fulham very soon.
Yes, you and I are scheduled to do the post-match show, and I'm glad that you mentioned upcoming shows. We are doing a post-match show on Saturday. The match is on Friday. We're going to do it Saturday at 7 p.m. in the U.K., which is 2 p.m. my time, and that's when we're going to do the post-match show. So right now it's just me and you, unless anyone else wants to join us. All right, and Mike, again, excellent job, and again, just great stuff on Viva El Fulham, my friend. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, cheers, Russ, and thanks for the nice words about the articles. And, yeah, I enjoyed the show. It was good, and hopefully I'm wrong, and we'll be celebrating tomorrow at 5 o'clock.
I hope so. I certainly hope so. All right. All right, it's time to wrap this show up. Before we go, just a reminder, you can download Cottage Talk on iTunes and on the Stitcher Radio app, which is available on the iPhone, iPad, and the Android. Also, you can now listen to Cottage Talk on the TuneIn app, which is available at most app stores for your mobile device. That's how I listen back to the show, on the TuneIn app. Well, that's it for this episode of Cottage Talk. For David and Mike, I'm Russ Goldman. Thank you again for listening to Cottage Talk. Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Thanks, Russ.
Cheers.
Thanks,
cheers.
See you, Mike. See you, Russ.
Cheers, guys.
Boys.